Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest, Lester Brown, began the first research institute devoted to global environmental issues back in 1974, paving the way for the modern-day environmental movement in many respects. He also helped pioneer the concept of sustainable development during a career in which he started out as a tomato farmer in New Jersey. Lester Brown has written 50 books on environmental issues, which have been translated into 40 languages. His new book is called World on the Edge: How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. For his work, Lester Brown has been awarded countless prizes and awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship, the UN Environment Prize, as well as 25 honorary degrees. The Washington Post has called him one of the world's most influential thinkers, and he's here with us right now. Lester Brown, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
Give me a little of your background. How did you go from tomato farming to being a guru for the environmental movement?
Well, I joined the Department of Agriculture after living in the villages in India. I was growing tomatoes, lived in the villages in India for half a year, came back and grew tomatoes for another year or two, but then realized that I really wanted to work on the world food population problem, and so I joined the Foreign Agricultural Service of the Department of Agriculture. And after a decade there, moved into the think tank world here in Washington, and that's where I've been ever since.
Your World Watch papers and World Watch State of the World reports were these annual State of the World books, bound
mm-hmm.
books,
yep.
And for me, they were the first publications that I ever read on the environment shortly after I was out of college. And I actually credit you for getting me interested in environmental issues, as I'm sure many others do. And back then, you were talking, if I remember correctly, about issues of global sustainability before it was a topic all tied up with global warming, correct?
Right. We were talking about soil erosion, deforestation, falling water tables, collapsing fisheries. And global warming was not on the early list in 1974 when we started. It made its way onto the list in a matter of years. But now we face a complex of issues, of just a number of environmental trends heading in the wrong direction. And those trends are beginning to put stress on society at the global level in the form of rising food prices.
And in your new book, World on the Edge: How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse, you talk about a global food bubble, which you fear will burst in a number of years. What do you mean by a global food bubble?
Well, a number of countries, in an effort to expand their food production, have turned to irrigation. They've been drilling wells by the million, literally. India's farmers have drilled, for example, 21 million wells. And at some point, the pumping from those wells exceeds the recharge from the monsoon season. And so water tables are falling. And when the aquifer is depleted, the rate of pumping necessarily will be reduced to the rate of recharge. What we don't know is exactly when these things will occur. We do know that in Saudi Arabia, which was self-sufficient in wheat for more than 20 years, because it was pumping from an aquifer a half mile down, that was a fossil aquifer. That is, it did not recharge at all. And so in the last 3 years, we've seen Saudi wheat production virtually collapse. And by next year, they'll probably be out of the wheat production business altogether. And that's a really dramatic, particularly dramatic example. But the two biggest food bubbles in the world are in India, where, according to World Bank data, 175 million Indians are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. And our estimate, comparable estimate for China, is that 130 million Chinese are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. And overpumping is, by definition, a short-term phenomenon. So it comes to an end at some point, as it already has so dramatically in Saudi Arabia.
And so your view is a long-term one, and yet this is in the news in some form right now. Last week we actually had the scholar Raj Patel on to talk about the record level of worldwide food prices right now and the link between those prices and the unrest in the Middle East and the specter of shortages. And today, the New York Times, in an editorial this very day, wrote about what they call the food crisis and said the U.S. government needs to give more money to help poor countries produce food. Do you see this as part of the same overall situation?
Well, clearly, a number of developing countries, importantly those in sub-Saharan Africa, need help with their agriculture. But what's interesting about this tightness in the food supply is it is not event-driven. It's not, you know, a monsoon failure in India or a drought in Russia or what have you. As it used to be, we would have these events, and then things will quickly return to normal. But with climate change, for example, there's now no norm to return to because our climate system is in a state of flux and constant change. What we're looking at now is a number of trends. On the demand side of the food equation, we have population growth. There will be 219,000 people at the dinner table tonight who were not there last night. We have rising affluence. That is an estimated 3 billion people trying to move up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive meat, milk, eggs, and so forth. And then third, we now have a growing diversion of grain into the production of fuel for cars. Here in the United States, last year we harvested 400 million tons of grain, and 120 million of that, well over a fourth, went to ethanol distilleries to produce fuel. So those are the three trends on the demand side. We now have three important drivers pushing demand upward, and the effect of this has been the annual rise in grain consumption has gone from roughly 20 million tons a year to just over 40 million tons a year.
Environmental pioneer Lester Brown, my guest on WNYC. His new book, approximately his 50th, is called World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. It's about what he calls a global food bubble, among some other things. And you're laying out a fairly apocalyptic scenario. What are some of the key solutions to these problems?
Well, on the supply side of the equation, we have two major ones. One is the Earth's rising temperature. And the rule of thumb among crop ecologists is that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields. That means that the temperature keeps rising. It's going to be taking a toll here and there, and sometimes really, really dramatically, as in Russia this past year. The other issue is the water issue. We need to launch water tables are falling in 18 countries now, which means we have 18 countries that are going to face likely reductions in their grain harvest, or at least a slower rate of growth as a result of water shortages. So we need to launch, in thinking about what to do, we need to launch a worldwide effort to raise water productivity similar to the one we launched in the late 50s and 60s to raise world cropland productivity.
Why would there be a water shortage? And I know you pursue the idea of peak water, like peak oil, where the water tables are generally in decline. But I thought global warming tends to make the world more moist.
It does. The higher the temperature, the more evaporation. That's sort of basic physics. But it has two effects. First, because the evaporation is more rapid, drought can develop more quickly. And because there is more water up there, more evaporation, then there will be more coming down. Exactly when and where it comes down, we can't always tell. The other big issue, by the way, is stabilizing world population. There are now some 215 million women in the world who want to plan their families but lack access to the family planning services they need to do so. These women, 215 million, and their families represent over a billion people. These are mostly the poorest 1 billion in the world. And we cannot afford for that gap in family planning to continue. It costs so little. It would get lost in the rounding of our defense budget, for example. It's that small, and yet it is one of the most important things that's going to be shaping our future.
So we have about 2 minutes left. How would you rate the Obama administration on its handling of these problems and issues?
Well, on the climate issue, President Obama did not put his weight behind anything on the Hill in the climate area. He was concentrating on health care. That was his big priority. On the other hand, in a number of key areas, they're making important contributions, raising fuel efficiency of cars, for example, in a way that we've not seen before, raising the efficiency standards for electrical household appliances. So they're doing a number of things in that vein, but not enough to really turn things around.
So in our last minute, some critics of environmentalists say, you know, they're always for the same things, smaller, restraining corporations, that kind of thing. They don't like capitalism. And they'll attach whatever new thing comes along. And so they were talking about all these same policies before they started talking about global warming. And maybe they're referring to you. And now they're saying, well, we have global warming, so we have to pursue these policies. Are you just attaching the new science to a previous agenda?
That's more complicated than it sounds. But it was interesting to hear President Medvedev in Moscow in early August, when the country was burning with 300 or 400 fires starting every day, say, you know, we were climate deniers. We are changing our position. And I think that was one of the most dramatic things to come out of that extraordinary heat wave and drought that Russia had.
Are we seeing, and we have 20 seconds, so is Russia changing its policies in meaningful ways?
I have not yet seen evidence of that. But what they do know is that climate change brings more extreme events, and they were the victim of one this past year.
Lester Brown, author of World on Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. He is president of the Earth Policy Institute, whose book Plan B, Mobilizing to Save Civilization, is also the basis of a new PBS documentary by the same name to air on PBS on March 31st. Lester Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.